And our guest, Doug Noel, this hour, we're going to take your phone calls with Doug as we talk about the prison system. All that and more next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Doug Noel with us. I've got a few more questions with Doug before we take calls. However, Will is telling me that we do have a phone call from Anonymous in San Quentin, California, in prison. I want to get him on now because apparently he has his cell phone kind of hidden away there.
Uh-oh.
Hello there, Anonymous. You with us?
Yes, sir. And Mr. Norrie, what an honor. That's all I can really say about that. What an honor.
Well, I'm glad you got through to us. Can you tell us what you're incarcerated for?
I'm currently incarcerated, serving a 3-year sentence for the cultivation of marijuana.
Okay.
Now, there you go, Doug. Another case where he really shouldn't be in prison for that.
That's exactly right.
Any chance? Go ahead.
I just wanted to say that I really like the point of view. Can you turn that off so I can? I really like the point of view of the individual that you have on tonight. I just wanted to say one thing, though, I totally agree. I, too, know people that have taken lives on accident or by force. It's never a good thing. Situations are always different, of course, but when it comes to pedophiles and children being messed with, I would never want them in my home.
No.
But that is just a personal opinion, of course.
Yeah.
Okay. So when do you get out, Anonymous? Pretty soon?
Yes, sir. I'd rather not say my out date, but I'm very close to the house, and I just can't wait to get back to my own 2-year-old son and my beautiful wife that's home, home as we speak.
All right. Good for you. Thanks for calling. I'm going to let you go. Go ahead, Doug. I'll let you react to what he said.
Oh, I was just going to say, cell phones, contraband in prison. That's a good way for him to get some more time. So I hope he keeps it hidden. they're death on that in California prisons.
Are they?
The administration.
I know they took it away from Charlie Manson.
Yeah, well, I can't even walk into a prison with a cell phone, and that's a big deal. So hopefully he's careful. Yeah, he's absolutely right. I mean, there are a lot of people with pedophiles and child molesters are the most reviled people in prison, and for good reason. I mean, they are mentally ill. They've done bad things, really bad things, to totally defenseless human beings, and in many cases, the carry on the abuse that causes those children later to become criminals themselves. I mean, it's awful. However, they're still human beings. I've actually had some people in my classes who are child molesters, and they have turned out to be pretty effective in the work of mediation. Whether or not they would be safe to be released on the outside, I don't know.
Here's an example, Doug. Listen, I love dogs. I happen to believe that pit bulls have been bred to fight, which is sad, and they've been trained to fight, and I think they've been abused by their owners. I think that pit bulls that haven't been trained to fight have a fighting chance to be okay. But if a pit bull attacked a human being, would you ever be safe with that dog around your kid? I wouldn't let that happen, would you?
Again, it really depends, case by case. First blush, I would want to be very, very, very careful. But dogs can be rehabilitated too. Some pit bulls can't be rehabilitated, but others can. It's totally case by case. And so what do you do with a dog? Well, I mean, a dog, you might have to destroy a dog. We sometimes destroy human beings, but what we don't do is look at them as human beings and say, is this a recoverable person who can go back into society and be safe and be a taxpayer and be productive? That's not how we look at it today. We tend to make blanket statements about people and we stereotype them and that's what costs us the money. And I really advocate that we've got to stop doing that.
Let's go to John.
On a case-by-case basis that a child molester or pedophile absolutely has to remain in prison. No question about that. But there may be other cases where it's not necessary. Where there is it, there's a chance to recover somebody. And we should think about that because it's cheaper and more
humane.
It
is cheaper. Let's go to John in Ballstown Spa, New York. John, thanks for calling. East of the Rockies? Well, he's not. He just dropped off. But let's go to Barbara in Buffalo. Hey, Barbara, go ahead.
Yes, indeed. I'm in awe. I almost thought I was dreaming. I've been a coast-to-coast listener since Larry King, excuse me, but I've been advocating for just what this man, Mr. Knowles, is doing, and I'm just in awe because I have an organization called Mothers of Those in Crisis, and I've been doing this volunteer. I have a list of inmates that have corresponded with me through my son who's been in jail because he was a substance abuser. I sought help for him when he was 16 before he ever got in trouble. There were some things that happened early in his life that I knew, I didn't know at the time, but it caused him some harm mentally. And he's been in and out. Everything Doug Knowles is saying, I thought I was dreaming when I first heard it. So what I'm going to do, I don't want to take up much time. I just cannot believe I'm hearing this, and I've been listening, and I listen at least 5 nights a week. I had almost dozed off because I'm doing just what he's talking about. I have a degree in community and human service and concentration on substance abuse.
Good for you, Barbara.
I'm in awe, so I'm not going to take up your time, but I'm sure before you go off, you're going to tell me how I can reach Mr. Knowles. It's Knowles, the man told me.
Give out your websites, Doug, and I'm sure people can email you that way.
Yeah. So my last name is Knoll, Doug Knoll. You can Google me and find out more than you ever want to know about me. The website to learn the skills that we're teaching the inmates, the transforming so many lives, is it's pure magic.com. It's puremagic.com. That'll redirect you to the website. My contact information is on the website. Be happy to hear from you.
And we've got links for Doug on Coast to Coast. They're all
right.
Over the place. Okay, super.
George, I just want to comment on something that Barbara said, which I think is really important for people to know. Criminals are not born. Criminals are bred.
I agree.
And that is something that we really forget, that the only reason that people go into antisocial behavior is because they have been abused or drug addicted themselves, or their mental illness has not been properly diagnosed or treated. And some people tend to be very violent, but that's probably because they have had an extremely abusive upbringing as children. The stories I hear in prison, I'll tell you one story. Very quickly, a guy, one of my older gentlemen, my first mediator in the men's prison, told us a story on the very first day of class last fall. He said, when I was 3 years old, I lived in the bayous of Louisiana. My uncles would take me out. One uncle would tie a rope around me and put it on a sapling. The other uncle would go out in a little pond, a little skiff with a shotgun, and the uncle on the shore would dip me in the water as crocodile bait. And when the crocs came up under the bank, my uncle would shoot them.
Unbelievable.
And you wonder why the guy's been in prison for 40 years.
Okay, what about a serial killer, Doug? That's
That's right.
Right?
That's the person I'm talking about who has to be protected from society, who's deeply mentally ill, probably not recoverable. You know, that's what prisons are for, people like that.
Well, I think so.
But I will also tell you that there is a woman that I work with, who I've worked with for 3 years now, who was a cult killer in her youth. She's been in prison for many years. She'll probably never get out. But she is one of the most powerful peacemakers and mediators I've ever trained and worked with. And she has completely transformed her life.
But she's good in the prison system, at least.
She is good. She functions well in the prison system. She has the only thing I can tell, I mean, I don't know all the details, but all I can say is that I have observed her work and teach and train, and she's one of the most effective people I've seen at teaching and training, mediation and peacemaking, and being an effective mediator that I've ever seen in my life. Amazing.
Let's go to first-time caller.
Person by person. I'm sorry?
No, I'm stepping over on you sometimes. Let's go to Frank in St. Louis, Missouri. Go ahead, Frank.
Hey, George, good to talk to you.
You too, Frank. Thanks.
Yeah, I'm calling because this subject really touches me. I was incarcerated in Huntsville, Texas. I was given a sentence of 2 years because I had 3 DWIs in a certain amount of time. And today I'm a felon.
How do you handle that, Doug? What do you think of that, Frank's situation, 3
it's
DUIs?
He obviously had a substance. Frank obviously had, hopefully he's gotten past it, an alcohol abuse problem. When you drive intoxicated, you're irresponsible and dangerous. So people need treatment. He does his time, but look at what society does to him. Now he's an ex-felon. He probably has incredible difficulty getting benefits. Every time he goes for a job, people ask him, you know, ever been convicted of felony? Yep. Application goes in the wastebasket. So how do you get employment? Our society is really vindictive and retributive, even when we say that when people have served their time, they should be getting out. It's the politicians, again, who are over-punishing people because they want this tough-on-crime mantra to get them elected and maintain their power, position, and privilege in state office. It's insane. It's inhumane. It's unjust. It's crazy. And it's costing us a friggin' fortune.
When we were talking about privatization, do you see the day that any of these companies, if they're not already, are publicly held, shareholder-owned?
Oh, I think some of them already are. In fact, I know the largest one out of Baton Rouge, Florida, is publicly owned. It's on the New York Stock Exchange.
Well, and that means they have to keep generating profit to the bottom line, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So I would guess they don't want people not going to prison. They want to collect as many bodies as they can, don't they?
Well, of course. I mean, and that was the whole mass incarceration movement was economically driven. Build more prison, create more jobs, you know. To heck with the taxpayers. And the private prison situation is the same. There are a lot of people today who believe that outsourcing things like prisons should not be the function of government. It should be something that's outsourced. Well, I don't, you know, maybe an argument could be made for that if the economic incentive was to rehabilitate, not to warehouse. But that's not the economic incentive. And so, So I worry about that. And, of course, when you privatize something like prisons, then it becomes much, much more distant from oversight and becomes much, much more difficult to raise as a social justice issue or as an economic issue if you're a conservative because it's a step and a half removed away from government.
So you had mentioned Republicans and Democrats, conservatives, liberals. Do they respectively have different views on prisons?
I don't think that once you understand what prisons are all about and how costly they are, both in terms of money and in terms of human suffering, I don't think most Democrats and Republicans will disagree on that. Where they might disagree is on stuff like retribution, you know, how strict do we want to be, how harsh do we want to be in penalizing people. But I also think it's funny how people of extreme polarities in their political views can actually find common ground on an issue like this, but for very different reasons. For the Tea Party people, they want to see government shrunk. Well, one of the largest aspects of government is the prison system. So you would think naturally they would want to see the prison system shrunk. The fiscal conservatives want to see less government spending. Well, fine, let's reduce spending on prisons and put it in somewhere else or put it back in the taxpayer's pocket. So they would like to see a reduction in prisons, one would think. And if you go to the far left, social justice people, they're going to talk about how, you know, the criminal laws are set up to discriminate against colored people and, you know, ethnicities and people who are not in positions of power and privilege. And so they're going to want to see the prison populations reduced. So there, I think a very strong consensus could be developed in this country to do something different than what we're doing right now. People may have different reasons for why they want to do it, but at the end of the day, it's you know, we've got a system here that's just not working.
No, not at all. Okay, back to the phones we go. Let's go to Suzanne in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Suzanne, thanks for calling. Go ahead. Suzanne, turn your radio down.
Conservatives want to see less government spending.
No, not going to happen, folks. Let's go.
Yep. Got to leave the radio off.
Yep, you got to turn it down. Bakersfield, California. Hello, Karen. You're up with us. Go ahead.
Thank you.
Sure.
My point is that I think that violent offenders ought to be incarcerated, but I do agree with your guest that the prison system does need to be revamped.
And how would you revamp that?
Well, I'm hardly knowledgeable there, but I do think that prison enforcement ought to be outsourced. because the government just doesn't do any good. It's obvious.
Well, now that's a good point, then. Thanks, Karen. That's a good point in terms of who would you recommend run these prisons, Doug? Would you prefer government be out of it altogether?
Oh, boy. You know, George, you could hit me on any given day and I might have a different opinion on that. I don't know. You know, on the one hand, I'm going to talk like a lawyer now. On the one hand, the problem is that the public unions have pretty much stripped the state legislatures of control over all of this because they're so the correctional peace officers are so powerful in every state. So that argues for privatization. But on the other hand, when you get to privatization, you lose oversight. And, if the incentives aren't properly established, and they usually won't be because of bureaucracy and protecting position and power position and privilege, then you get into warehousing and no rehabilitation. So there's not a good argument for either one. And that's a policy debate that would really has to be thrashed out. But I think it will best be thrashed out under intense public pressure to change what we're doing right now. So that I'd rather have us put $13 billion in education instead of in prisons. And that's the public policy debate we got to have. Where that ultimately falls out, I'm not sure.
All right, let's go to Gary in Sacramento, California. Hey, Gary, thank you.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing, Gary.
Great subject. You really caught my ear when you were talking about forgiveness. And I really think we have a rampant societal illness. As young folks, many don't have a healthy release of their anger. And I think we all might agree that anger is actually fear-related.
Yeah.
So what I use is I try to change the mind, and sometimes that takes time. So I say to myself, forgive them, for they know not what they do. When I'm telling myself that, I'm not telling myself that they didn't know what they were doing. I look at it like an ant colony or a beehive, the mind of collective consciousness of the whole colony. And where human beings are concerned, murder is a crime against humanity, and that's also a crime against oneself. So I have to look at this also like if I have a resentment against you, actually, I'm allowing you to have a hook in me. And also, I'm learning the difference between judging and discerning.
Mm-hmm. Good.
I can see what is done wrong and where some crimes need incarceration. But it's
there's no doubt.
When I learn proper discernment. And this all helps me move on, and it works. And I thank you very, very much.
All right, Gary, thanks for your statement. Almost at the break here, Doug, but we'll come back because they keep calling here for you.
On for as long as you need me, George.
That's okay. And let me ask you, too, with all of this, 15 seconds or such, is it doable in every prison system, not just California?
I think so. I think it's doable everywhere.
All right. Stay with us, Doug Knoll. We're going to come back in just a moment. We'll take final phone calls with Doug. And, of course, this is a split show for you this Sunday night into Monday morning. So we'll talk a little bit about the supernatural world a little bit later on here on Coast to Coast AM. And if you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com. Well, stay connected to some of the greatest radio stations across the country. Just download the free iHeartRadio app today in the store, iHeartRadio app, or listen at iHeartRadio.com. And welcome back with Doug Knoll. We're talking about Prison of Peace, and of course, we're taking your final phone calls with our final segment. He's also the author of Elusive Peace, How Modern Diplomatic Strategies Could Better Resolve World Conflicts. I'm wondering, too, Doug, if you utilize this technique, this kind of training, as you do in the prison systems, why don't we put government leaders through this program?
I agree, George. That's what the book is all about. I argue that we really need to professionalize international conflict mediation, because when you allow people who don't have any training of the type that we teach to go out and try to make peace, they do a pretty bad job of it.
Well, they sure do.
Anyways, the thing about my life is that whether I'm working in prisons or I'm working at the international level, the tools are the same, essentially. Human conflict is human conflict. There are very specific tools that we can teach and train anybody how to de-escalate somebody in 90 seconds or less. It works in the prisons. It works in international conflict mediations. It works in family business conflicts. It works everywhere. Human brains are very predictable in how they respond to conflict and how they respond to proper interventions by mediators. It's amazing to watch.
Well, when you talk about discoveries in neuroscience, how will that help us?
Well, I think it's going to scare the crap out of a lot of people, because the science is totally upending our assumptions about human behavior. And we're learning that the human brain is a marvelous complex device, but it also has a lot of interesting idiosyncrasies that it's developed as it's gone through an evolutionary process. And some of the things that I think are going to come out of this are, one, we are developing better skills to deal with people, for example, who are angry. We can now teach people how to de-escalate angry people in 90 seconds or less. More fundamentally, I think that we now know from neuroscience and cognitive neuropsychology that the whole basis of legal evidence in the courtroom on eyewitness testimony is completely unreliable. And the laws of evidence that have been around for 500 years are wrong. They're just wrong in their assumptions about human behavior. So we're going to see some fundamental changes in the next couple of hundred years in how the law and how our society deals with problems, because what we thought we knew about human behavior is now quite a bit different than it was even 20 years ago. And I think that ultimately we won't have crime like we have it today. We won't have prisons like we have them today. I think in 100 or 150 years, this is going to be seen as a mental health, public health problem, and it's going to be handled in a much, much different way than it is today. And I think it's going to take us a long time to get there, because there's a lot of baggage that our society carries around this sort of stuff, but the science is pointing the way. And it's showing us that what the criminal brain really looks like. And there is a distinction between somebody who's a psychopath and somebody who's normal. There are very distinct differences in the human brain, and we can see that now. And I think that's going to, over the years, inform us about how we respond to these problems that are so devastating for both victim survivors, and devastating for offenders, too. And how do we manage that in a better way?
What do you think of the Saudi Arabia form of treatment, where if you steal, they cut off your hand?
Right. You notice that the only people that get their hands cut off are the people at the bottom of the social caste.
Right.
You don't see the princes getting their hands chopped off.
No. That would never happen.
Exactly. So it's all about power, position, and privilege. And you can say, you'll remember years ago the caning that occurred the city state. Oh, why am I drawing a blank on it? The kid was tossed chewing gum on the ground, or was disrespectful or something, and he was publicly flogged in Singapore. Capital punishment, we know a couple of things. We know that capital punishment and incarcerating people and punishing people generally does not deter them. Most criminal behavior is emotional in nature. Most of it is. Most of it is not premeditated. Most of it is based on mental illness and addictive disorder, so people are really not in complete control of their rational. They're not making rational choices. They're making emotional decisions that over which they have little or no control, contrary to many beliefs about conscious control. And we're learning about this stuff. So Saudi Arabia doesn't have any less crime than anybody else, even though they're more violent about it. It's just their way of maintaining social control.
Yeah. I mean, they're tough in Singapore. I mean, there is literally a ban on chewing gum in Singapore unless it's prescribed by a doctor for therapeutic reasons. And apparently what had happened there, Doug, is for maintenance problems in their unbelievably high-rise public housing. People apparently were putting gum on floors, stairways, pavements. People were sticking to it. So they've just passed a law and said, you can't chew gum. That's it.
Right. So if you like living in that kind of very, very organized, tightly controlled, restricted society with very little political liberties, some other kinds of liberties, mostly economic liberties, then that's great.
We're getting there.
People should be free to live there. That's not where I care to live, but I think we have to make choices about how much control we want to have. And we do know that social control through violence typically does not work. It never has worked.
We're getting there, though. That's the problem. Gary in El Paso, Texas.
Problem.
Hi, Gary. Go ahead.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yep, sure can. Loud and clear.
Okay. All right. I think it starts, you know, I think it starts from the public defender's position. You know, they if I had a paid attorney who was going to fight tooth and nail for me, I wouldn't have ended up settling for a plea agreement and wouldn't have been sent to a prison for 2 years. And also, the guards there, they have a list, and they bid on their jobs anywhere from $24 an hour to $60 an hour. The prison system is a money-making thing. The corporations, the CCAs that are out there, they're all about the money. If they don't have a building to put these individuals, they call a private corporation to build a prison, and they house anywhere from 1,600 to 2,500 inmates at a time. You know, it's all about the money. They're not going to give up that money. These guards that are working in these places, they're not going to give up their big-time wages, you know, for a program that, you know, they're going to fight against it. I can picture them now fighting against it. So that's my take on it.
No, you're right. It is all about the money. I think that's the problem, Doug.
It's totally about the money. And you're right. There will be a lot of resistance. There's going to be huge political resistance to any kind of meaningful reform. But by airing this out in the public forum, like on Coast to Coast, where people can listen and think and use their noggins and say, does this make sense to me? The more people that can become aware of the problem and think about the issue, the easier it is to have a public debate about this and have a public conversation and maybe make a decision that, gee, I don't want to spend, you know, 135% more money on prisons than I'm spending on education. I'd rather put the money back into education. We need to have that discussion. And whether or not there'll be shifts or not, if they are, they'll be slow, no doubt about that. But by at least talking about it, we're not covering it up, and we're not being ignorant about it. We're not being stupid about it. And I think that's the most important thing for me.
We have Waldo in Ontario, Canada, on the international line. Waldo, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Oh, George, it's always a pleasure. Long-time listener. I'm going to tell you that I have two questions for your guest today. One is, has he ever been traumatized or victimized by homicide?
No.
That's the first one. And the second was, if not, how is he going to come on to national radio and try to get us to acquiesce to this forgiveness jargon that he's talking about? I personally have been victimized by a double homicide, 29-year-old sister and 4-year-old nephew, and your guest got my blood boiling because I can't even imagine or even begin to even fathom the idea of when this guy gets caught, because he's still out there, what's going to happen, how I'm going to react, because in my head, I'd camp out and wait for him, you know, because I'm just floored with the comment that came out of his mouth about this forgiveness thing. I just want to know if he's got anything to back it up, or is he just telling us just to acquiesce to this whole thing, because
let's let you go with this. I knew eventually we'd get a call.
First of all, I in no way may have any judgment about forgiveness or not. And to the extent that the caller has been traumatized by a double homicide, it's a horrible, tragic thing. He's obviously very angry, very hurt, lots of grief. There is no reason for him to forgive at all if he doesn't want to go through the process. And there is nobody in the world that should tell him to forgive. There is nobody that should make a demand on him to forgive. It's his life and it's his journey. All I'm saying is that if you do go through a forgiveness process, it's a three-step process. And that's all you – the most effective forgiveness is a three-step process. If you choose – and if it's right for you to go through that process, and that's what you choose to do, you've got to go through the three steps that I talked about. I will also say that I have mediated victim-offender disputes between victim survivors and homicide and offenders, and I have seen amazing things happen. But that's not to say that it would be appropriate in every case. In fact, it's probably only appropriate in 40 to 50% of the cases where it might be possible. And but when people do confront after a period of time and with many years of preparation, they do confront each other, sometimes some pretty amazing stuff can happen. So it's not impossible, but it's also very, very difficult. And my heart goes out to the man who just called. Obviously, he's in a lot of pain, and I hope that he can find justice and a way of healing his suffering in some way. Very, very difficult.
Well, let's go to Kendall in Huntington Beach, California, first-time caller. Kendall, thanks for holding so long. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to call. This is a topic that I am actually studying at school. I started college for the first time in 20 years.
Well, good for you.
And I'm doing peace and conflict and negotiation studies. My husband was arrested for the first time. He is in prison for the first time at 45. He got in a fight and got sentenced to 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Going through that process, our criminal process, horrified me. It absolutely horrified me. I mean, the public defenders and the DA are in bed together from the get-go. So you're starting off with a deficit if you don't have a private attorney. And they wheel and deal. They make deals, you know, I'll give you this guy, you give me that guy. And then, you know, we send these guys that to prison that it's not working. We have 2 million Americans incarcerated. We incarcerate more than Russia, China, any other country. We incarcerate more. We're spending more and we're getting less return on it. We're not rehabilitating these people.
Not at all. Not at all.
Not at all. If anything, we're making it worse.
Are we making it worse, Doug?
Well, if you define by making it worse, not preparing, one, putting too many people in prison, yes. Two, when they get in prison, not giving them the tools to, if they exit prison, to live productive lives as taxpaying citizens. We're making it worse. We're making it worse. Absolutely.
Not good. Not good. And then at what point does it bite us, huh?
It bites us every time somebody gets released who has not been, what has been mentally, is mentally ill, has been physically abused, went to prison, was abused in prison, is now released with no tools and with a stigma of being an ex-con, and goes out and hurts some other people in the community. That's how it hurts us. And
Mike,
we blame that person, and we don't blame ourselves and our politicians and our system for the error of our ways. And we need to take as much blame for that as the people who are actually committing the recidivating and reoffending.
Go to Mike in Ohio. Hey, Mike, go ahead.
Good evening. How are you?
Good. All is well. Thank you.
Hi. I was incarcerated for a little over 5 years in federal prison for a slew of charges, the chief among them being arson. And just from firsthand experience, I wanted to let the world know that it is worse than failing to provide correction. It is flat out counterproductive. Because you start with law enforcement that's bent. You start with courts that are, and then the courts that are bent to a system that is bent to a post-release setup that is entirely counterproductive and actually makes it harder to succeed and to function in society.
Yeah.
It's infuriating. And you know, the little details they don't talk about, the way was just on brought up the joke that is the public defender's office. In the mm-hmm. federal system, we call them federal pretenders.
Did you use that? Is that what you had to use, Mike?
What, yeah, unfortunately, I was too broke for a real attorney, so I got... I mean, they actually get a kickback. They get billable hours added to their pay if you take a plea agreement rather than going to trial.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and then you get to the system, you see things like Unicor, wage slavery, where the federal government... I could be on and talk nonstop for half an hour of all the things a person sees. And
what about
you can't help but be angry and bitter.
And let me ask you about your case if you would want to share that with us. What did you burn down?
I set fire to some construction equipment.
For insurance or what?
No, it was owned by one of the personalities in the Cuyahoga County corruption scandal.
Okay.
I don't know if you've heard about that.
No, not exactly, but I assume you were just trying to get back at him.
It was annoying. It irked everybody in the county. Cuyahoga County is where Cleveland is, for those who don't know.
Okay.
And they were railroading the entire county for millions every year. Everybody, but then it hit a personal level when it started affecting my brother, who is a city worker.
So you were like the vigilante, but you got caught for it.
Yeah, I got ratted out for it. One of my former friends... decided to drop my name and he got jammed up on something else.
Okay, yeah. Doug, let's get your reaction to this situation. I mean, here...
Well, you know, we've heard from several callers now complaints about the public defender and the district attorney, and there is truth to that. I mean, most public defenders are people who are really trying to do a good job. They're underpaid, they're understaffed, they don't have any of the resources that the prosecutors get for the most part. And, you know, for them, it's managing cases. And plea bargaining is the way of life in the criminal courts, whether it's in the state court or the federal courts. Most cases get bargained out. And it can be incredibly unjust. I mean, there is no question that we have a system of criminal justice that is based on your wealth. If you're wealthy, you have a much better shot working through the system than if you're poor.
Unless you're burning animals,
I don't even
right?
want to go. I mean, we've been talking about prisons tonight. We haven't even talked about the front-end problems that we've got in our society. It's just crazy.
What about the white-collar criminals? What do we do with them? Same thing?
Well, you know, again, it depends. It depends on what they've done. For most people, most white-collar crime is either tax evasion or some kind of fraud where they bilk people out of, you know, I mean, we think of the Madoffs bilking as one of the more massive examples of that.
Right.
For them, going to prison, they don't go to prison for very long, but it's a complete and total destruction of their reputation. And for those people, that is often sufficient punishment here. They were looked at as fine, upstanding, wealthy people, and now
it's over.
They've been stripped of their wealth. They've been stripped of their reputation. They've been stripped of their dignity. I mean, that's you know. That's probably sufficient, and spend some time in the federal penitentiary. But you notice that the fact that we have all these laws, securities fraud laws and racketeering laws and all these laws, both civil and criminal, and yet people still on Wall Street still engage in these criminal
acts. Oh, they don't stop. Doug, thank you for being on the program. Continued well wishes to you and your Prison of Peace project.